everyone.
Good morning. This is the time set for oral argument in Oshiro versus Oshiro, case number 89205. I'm sure counsel are familiar with the change in protocol, but we're now allotting 17 minutes per side with the first two uninterrupted. So you get to speak your piece without interference from us in the first 2 minutes. And with that, I would call the case and ask you to approach the podium and tell the clerk how much time you want for rebuttal. The rules of appellate procedure, you didn't file a reply, but the rules now allow rebuttal, notwithstanding that.
Thank you. 2 minutes for rebuttal would be
fine.
Thank you. Thank you. Lynn Hughes for the appellant. I'm hoping you read everything and you understand the facts. I don't really want to dig back into the facts and go to it, but essentially the trial court issued a ruling with an extreme distribution or disproportionate distribution of the combined Social Security of the parties. However, in my mind, the court's ruling was flawed. At the trial, the only issue we had was alimony. Everything else had been determined, property, and et cetera. The assets that were available at the time of the trial were Mr. Oshiro's veterans disability, his Social Security award or payment, and her Social Security award. And the court then, well, as I understand it, Social Security is not a property that can be used in property settlements. Under Wolf versus Wolf in 1996, this court has determined that the future Social Security incomes are not deferred compensation. They are essentially the separate property of the individual party. But in this court, in finding number 17, the trial court specifically found under 125.151b that the court is allowed, under 1.6, the court is allowed to disproportionately divide the community property of the marriage if there is a compelling reason to do so. And then awarded alimony out of the available assets to the parties. So they used a community property division to award alimony. And that's part, I think that the ruling is a little convoluted that way. The trial court ordered Mr. Oshiro to pay $2,000 to Mrs. Oshiro as alimony. The court did not declare where that money was to come from. And so if we uphold the statute 125.165, we are not allowed to divide the veterans' disability.
But is there anything in that statute, counsel, that says that you can't consider it for the distribution or for alimony, for purposes of alimony? So we have community property in one bucket, and then we have alimony in another bucket. And then 125.165 talks about not dividing the military benefit. But does it say anywhere that you can't consider it on whole to determine the relative incomes of both parties?
So you're going to the Conti case, which came up, I'm assuming, in June, that the appellate court brought forward. And yes, there is no language about considering it. But in this case, it became while it's considered, they divided the Social Security in such an extreme way that I don't know that that is appropriate, especially because there are no findings that support such a disproportionate division of that Social Security.
Well, aren't there findings that the respondent here had significant financial need and that Mr. Oshiro's income during the marriage had been the primary source of support, and this divorce had left her in a significantly worse financial position, unable to support herself?
Yes, and those are our proper alimony findings. But there's no, when we're talking about dividing the property under 125.150.16, for that, the case law says if one spouse wasted funds or hid assets, that's one of the grounds for dividing the property disproportionately, or community property was lost or destroyed or hidden. And we didn't have any findings of any behavior on Mr. Oshiro's part for sliding the scale that far.
So you agree, of course, that what we're dealing with is alimony, not division of property, right? Okay.
That is the main issue. I'm confused as to what the trial court did with citing the community property division and then arguing the alimony points. And again, the scale for me is so wrong.
So NRS 125.151B deals with disposition of community property, right?
Yes.
And so to the extent we are dealing with alimony, that provision doesn't even apply, does it?
I guess, no, I would say that it doesn't. And yet that was one of the findings of the trial court.
All right. And so I guess I'm not clear what your argument is then.
Yeah, it's a bit muddled. One of the things that I am worried about is this disparate division of the Social Security is so huge. And the alimony is not there to make sure that they have equal outcomes at the end of it.
Right.
And yet that seems to be the equity that the court was looking to strive toward, is to get something more, obviously, for her equitably, so that she is able to continue to live forward.
So the statute itself, 125.150, lays out the 11 different considerations appropriate in determining an alimony award, right?
Yes, I think those factors are appropriate. I just think that the scale of it is so extreme. They have left nothing but Mr. Oshiro's veteran's disability and then less than 3% of the Social Security.
Which actually leaves him with more income each month than his now ex-wife.
That is correct. But the veteran's disability, the purpose of it is for him to be able to continue to live on after having that award. He has not only the same bills that she has, but he has medical issues he has to deal with, including medical equipment, caregivers, and now that's all restricted severely by, again, this award of alimony.
Did he demonstrate those needs at the trial about alimony?
Those were not part of her findings, no.
Well, did he present, present evidence going to those? Because those would be appropriate considerations in evaluating alimony.
No, they were not.
Like his financial needs, his monthly expenses, the things he needs to pay for to survive. Those would all be appropriate considerations for alimony. Were they presented?
They were not, Your Honor. No.
In fact, there was some evidence to suggest that he's actually getting some assistance from his daughter, and I guess I'm also struggling to understand that argument as well, because under NRS 125.150, you know, the first thing on the list is financial condition of each spouse.
Right.
And so when you just look at the record that we have before us, we have a very disproportionate financial condition for each spouse, with your client maintaining the majority and his military benefits, which I think we are allowed to consider unless you convince me otherwise. If there's a statute, a rule, even the legislative history had the word consider in it before, and upon adoption, they removed those words from there. So I think it seems pretty clear to me from just the plain text of the statute that while we can't divide it, we can certainly consider it in the first factor of 125.150, which is the financial condition of each spouse. So why is that not a correct assessment?
The disproportionate share leaves him, again, just less than 3% of the Social Security. And to me is essentially the same thing as dipping into the veterans and equitably dividing that. For an equitable purpose, yes, but it is diving in my mind into that, or at least coming so extremely close. And I cannot understand where the bright line is that says where that apportionment should be. A respondent's brief goes into using Byrd versus Byrd. They say that because there was no assignment of any particular interest, they didn't order where he was supposed to pay the spousal support from, therefore they can go ahead and dip into the veterans disability benefits.
Well, but they're not dipping into the veterans disability benefits. You have $7,000 of income stream,
right?
And the wife gets $3,000 and the husband gets $4,000 of that income stream under the financial condition analysis that the court set and the award of alimony that it made, it did not dip into, I mean, if you go into the numbers exactly, it did not assign or dip into the veteran's disability benefit at all. It steered clear of that line. And it did consider the living costs and needs and the evidence that it was presented. So it, I'm hard pressed to follow your argument. And on that, are you arguing that it is, that the standard of review is that there was a legal error committed by the district court, or are you arguing that it was an abuse of discretion?
So I do believe it was abuse of discretion.
Okay. So you're not arguing that the district court misconstrued any statutes?
I do feel that the court kind of blended its ruling when quoting and dividing the what it called community property of the Social Security and also the alimony to reach its decision.
But the community property division was almost non-existent. They had,
correct.
There was no substantial income generating assets that were divided, and really no, their living expenses were going to be ongoing to put a roof over their heads.
Correct.
Right?
Yes. And so I believe there was a slight error in using the community property statute, but I don't know that that's enough to warrant. I just found it confusing in reviewing this and preparing for argument here today.
Is it your argument then? Are you arguing that NRS 125.165 requires that the court not consider his disability benefits at all in its analysis?
I would argue that, yes, that it should be not considered. Now, I've read Conte. I understand the argument there. Matter of fact, if Your Honor would review that, our office has actually argued the Conte case from Mel Grimes. But we still have that position that we feel it should not be considered. I understand the Conte case and its implications here.
It's an unpublished order, isn't it, from the Court of Appeals?
I thought it had.
I mean, it can be cited to us. Don't get me wrong. It can be cited to us, but it's not a published.
I apologize. I thought it had been published.
Okay.
It's not published, okay. But it's perfectly citable.
Yes.
Okay. Our argument would be that it should not be considered, that it should not be part of that, that the statute clearly comes down and says it's not available to be attached, levied, et cetera.
Okay.
Also, there's a section.
Or divided. I mean, the word divided is in our statute, not in the federal statute. And I understand that. The problem that I have is it wasn't. Like if she, the judge, had ordered $3,000 instead of $2,000 in order to collect that, if your client had not paid, there would have to be a levy or an execution on some portion of the income stream generated by the veteran's disability benefits. And that would be a different case. I'm not saying how I would come out on that, but that would be a different situation. But here, if there was a default, the judge steered clear at 96.7% or whatever. So that could be attached or collected from the Social Security income stream. So they didn't cross that statutory line. So my problem is, analytically, where's the statutory offense, particularly given that the legislature put in consider and then took it out in its adoption of 165?
I guess I'm trying to understand where that bright line is. If she had awarded 100% of Social Security to go over and left him only the veterans, is that an acceptable outcome for...
Well, during the marriage, it's my understanding the court found that all of the incomes, the Social Security benefits for both each of them and the veteran's disability benefit, were all put into one combined joint bank account during the marriage, and they paid their expenses from that joint account, right? And is there evidence that they didn't use income from the disability benefits to support the two of them in their marriage?
No, there is no evidence of that. It was a joint account. They used all of the assets to support their marriage. It's a tough case. And I come here trying to, I guess, find that bright line. Because to me, getting such
a... The question is there a bright line, or is it up to the district court to consider all the evidence before it, including the monthly disability benefit, and do the best she can to allow these people to live and support themselves going forward?
Yes. I only have a few seconds here. But it's just the property is supposed to be divided as equally and fairly as possible. And in alimony, yes, she does have a great need, but we're also facing that veteran's disability as a block. And I don't know what that bright line is. And again, I'm hoping this court understands that veteran's disability benefit, it does say cannot divide, even for the purpose of alimony.
Right.
And I'll reserve my time.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The district court correctly concluded that it must account for all streams of Robert Oshiro's actual income, including military disability benefits, to calculate alimony, and that the plain, unambiguous language of NRS 125.165 does not prohibit that process or the resulting award. Sherilyn Oshiro asks this court to affirm the district court's analysis and resulting divorce decree in a published decision. Adopting Sherilyn's position will align this court with the Court of Appeals decision just a few months ago in Conti v. Conti, and align Nevada with the vast weight of national case law. The U.S. Supreme Court and a supermajority of state courts interpreting NRS 125.165's federal cognate, as well as the U.S. FSPA, hold that those statutes prevent collection of disability benefits by outside creditors and division of those benefits as community property, but not the consideration of disability benefits as income for determining alimony. Mm-hmm. That result also accords with the U.S. Supreme Court's observation that disability payments are intended to benefit the veteran and his or her family. A contrary decision, adopting Robert's position, would defy the statute's plain language by adding a word, consider, that the legislature explicitly deleted from earlier drafts. Such a decision would create a categorical exception that does not exist anywhere else in federal or state law to the general rule that a district court should consider all streams of actual income in determining alimony. If that is Robert's desired result, the appropriate venue for that argument is the state house, not the courthouse. And with that, I welcome the court's questions.
So what if the court had awarded enough such that it would completely consume his Social Security and some of his military benefits? Would that be a different analysis?
No, Your Honor. So the process is the same, and the task of the court is the same regardless of the amount of money involved. So we're looking at two different processes. On one hand is the division of community property. I think we've heard from counsel a concession that there was no division of community property, and I think that that's pretty easily confirmed when you look at the record. And then on the other hand, we have the calculation of an alimony award. And Nevada law is very clear that those are two different processes. Justices Kadish and Pickering, Your Honors, wrote about this in the concurrence in Martin v. Martin, and that those two processes have very different roles. Rose v. Rose also speaks to this as well, I think quite lucidly, that the division of community property assets has a sort of they call it a non-moral business obligation, something like that, that we're really taking these little packages and cutting them in half, or, you know, however they're divided, versus an alimony award, which has a moral aspect, a moral obligation to support the family after the family has been broken up.
Yeah, so I understand the distinction, but if we're talking about So what the court did here, it ordered about 96% of, I mean, if we're looking at it this way, of the Social Security benefits while maintaining the full veterans disability benefits intact without touching those. But what if the court had awarded an amount such that it would have completely taken up all the Social Security benefits and some of his veteran benefits? Would that be a different analysis because now you are encroaching on those veterans? Is that in essence an equitable division of his veterans' benefits, disability benefits, contrary to the statute?
No, and I hope I don't repeat. If I repeat myself, I apologize. It's not my intention. So I think the word essentially, I'm thinking of the one state case that has indicated some allergy to including disability benefits in a consideration of alimony is the Ex parte Billet case, which is cited in Conti v. Conti. And in that case is a line that says, well, this is essentially the same thing. And there are a few problems with that. One, it is not the same thing. And that what I was trying to say and articulately is that the division of community property assets is a different process than an award of alimony.
But so NRS 125.165 explicitly also applies to the making of an award of alimony as well. So if it precludes a division of federal disability benefits in an award of alimony, what does that mean?
So, Your Honor, that would look something like a award of a particular percentage of his disability benefits, of all of the disability benefits, of an ex parte billet.
But actually, if the court just said pay a certain amount of dollars, which necessarily would include some of the dollars from disability, that would not be a division of benefits.
That's correct. And that is the state of the law. So you have these two. The beginning process is the, you know, taking the universe of income into account. And in that process, you're really not, because there are no categorical exceptions, you're really not calling one bucket one thing and another bucket one thing, or there's this many dollars or this much percentage. You're looking at the universe of the marriage and then figuring out what that award is. And then once the award is made, there's obviously the payment of it. And Nevada law, Bird v. Bird, and federal law is very clear that once an award is made, you have to pay that award from any available resource. And that is true regardless. If the only income that Robert had was disability, it would be the same calculus. The award would be different, obviously, but that is the state of the law.
What significance, if any, do you attach to the inclusion of the word divide in 165 Nevada statute and its absence in 38 U.S.C. 5301, from which some of the language in 165 appears to derive?
The significance I do not subscribe to it is that it's the same as considering. So that's the most important part, right? I think attachment, levy, and seizure.
What were they getting at by adding in divide? I mean, arguably it is, to Justice Kadish's point, in fairness, that if this district court judge had awarded an amount that required dipping into the veterans disability share of the income stream to meet it, would that be a different argument? I get that that's not the issue today, but it looks like cases elsewhere are saying, no, it doesn't matter for the reasons you've outlined.
That's correct. And I think the attachment levy seizure, which does appear in the federal statute, speaks to a different component than divide. So the attachment levy and seizure would be, it's been addressed differently. So in Rose v. Rose, we were talking about a contempt order, for example, an order that would enforce an award of alimony. Here, the division is speaking to the community property, you know, the division of community property assets.
And so you think division was added to address community property division? And that explains it. I mean, if you were writing this opinion, what would you do with the addition of the word divide?
I would say that it explicitly addresses community property assets. And I think it speaks to the legislative history of, you know, the statute went through so much meat grinding, so to speak, to get to its final state. And I think there was a lot of anxiety in the legislature about, you know, the way that it ended up was people saying, well, okay, we're basically adopting the federal statute. And the reason for it is that, you know, there's a problem, either perceived or actual, that district courts are not treating military disability benefits correctly, or they're dividing them without any, you know, licensure to do so. And so this anxiety about division maybe led to that additional word. So I think
what happens if there's a default in payments? Let's take your the hypothetical you alluded to, that the only income available to for alimony and support is the veteran's disability. What if that were the case and that were split 50-50? Mm-hmm. And the payor, the person whose benefits, who was receiving them, didn't pay? How would that be collected?
So that would be Rose v. Rose. And so in that case, there was a contempt order being enforced against a veteran spouse whose only financial resource was his disability benefits. And so the question was, you know, is this an attachment, levy, or seizure? The majority opinion says no, there's an exception, and the exception is, you know, motivated by congressional intent. I personally think Justice O'Connor's concurrence is more lucid on the point that there are many statutes that govern anti-attachment of assets, streams of income, federal, you know, things that are federally governed. And almost universally, those statutes have an exception by common law, by statute, for awards of family support because of the nature of that support, and also the additional evident congressional intent that the disability benefits are intended for a veteran and his family.
How do you distinguish the Mansell and Howell cases cited by the other side?
So to me, they're entirely distinguishable in the sense that what happened in those cases simply did not happen here. Howell and Mansell discuss an aspect of the USFSPA. I apologize for throwing an acronym in my introduction. I should have explained it first, but lessons learned. And those two cases are saying, okay, you have retirement pay, and retirement pay is a community asset. It's taxable. And so that's the kind of purpose of the statute, is to reserve it as a community property asset. The statute defines community property, and it, what has been determined is that the portion of retirement pay that's waived for disability benefits is no longer part of community property, is no longer governed by the USFSPA, and can no longer be divided as a community property asset. So that's Howell, or Mansell. And then Howell is saying, well, you also can't indemnify the spouse from whatever's left. There's no retirement pay here. There is no waiver, and there was no division of community property assets. So those specific cases really have nothing to say about this case. It so happens that what little they do have to say that's relevant is very helpful to Sherlyn's position, which is the end of Mansell saying, well, okay, you know, you can include a waiver as a community property asset, but we're not saying you can't consider it in determining alimony. And then you also have this line of, you know, 15 state court cases, 15 out of 17, saying, you know, to the extent the USFSPA has anything to say about considerations you can make in determining alimony, it doesn't require that you exclude military disability benefits. So the line of cases is not particularly useful, but everything that kind of the off gas of it is useful for Sherlyn.
And what about counsel's argument about the court kind of blurring the lines between the division of community property versus alimony?
So I'm not confused about the district court's order. I think the district court order is quite clear that it applied the factors under NRS 125.150 subsection 9. It concluded that those factors were not cabined or restrained or limited by NRS 125.165, Nevada's anti-attachment statute. It took into account all the factors that your honors have already identified, that Sherlyn is elderly, is disabled, not able to work, has lesser financial means, and came up with an alimony award. The divorce decree does cite to the statute that we're discussing about the division of community property. It doesn't apply that statute. I suspect it was either a misunderstanding or a mistake, but there is nothing else in the order that says, we are dividing a community property asset. this isn't an equitable division. And in fact, it is, I mean, well-held Nevada law that Social Security income is not a community property asset and cannot be divided. And it is also true that it is, again, another stream of income along with military disability benefits that the court can take into account. And that's exactly what the court did.
So does the requirement in 125.151B that requiring a compelling reason to make an unequal disposition, does that apply to our case at all?
No, because there is no division and there's no community property. So there's no compelling reason necessary. I bootstrapped myself in the brief by saying if it so happens that for whatever reason you determine it's community property, then there are compelling reasons, but it's right. Just not the case. And then I think we heard some indications from counsel that he's now arguing other factors of NRS 125.150 subsection 9, which has all those factors in it. Those are not factors that were addressed before the district court. They were not argued before the district court. They were not argued on appeal. So to the extent that opposing counsel wants to address an abuse of discretion on those points, it has been waived since the beginning. So I don't think there's an abuse of discretion. And, you know, the last thing I'd add is that an argument that the social, there's been an extreme 96% division of Social Security is inherently a concession that there has not been any colorable division of military disability benefits. So it's helpful to ask them in that way as well. So just to conclude, unless your honors have any other questions, Sherilyn asks the court to affirm the divorce decree in a published opinion based on a straightforward application of NRS 125.165. The statute's plain language prohibits dividing, attaching, levying, or seizing military disability benefits, but not considering those benefits in determining an individual's financial condition for purposes of an alimony award. This result accords with the statute's extensive legislative history and aligns Nevada with the U.S. Supreme Court and the vast weight of national case law. Thank the court for its time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have just under 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In just kind of a quick wrap-up, I want to go back to the plain language of the statute, 125.165, because it is very apparent that in making an award of alimony, you cannot divide or assign any portion of the military veteran's disability.
And how did the court here do so?
Well, I mean, I'm arguing, I guess, against the point that they're saying even if it were divided equally between the two parties, that this money now just becomes available money to pay whatever the award would be, including out of the veteran's disability. And I find that to be a direct violation of the plain language of the statute.
So, is what the court did actually in this case a direct violation of the statute?
Where I have my problem, I guess, here is that it is being considered. And again, in my mind, the plain language of the statute says when making an award that this should not be considered. I understand the language of Conti, but I still think that it is being considered and being obviously therefore equitably divided when it should just be, in my mind, the Social Security that is doing that.
Would you agree that the vast majority of cases that have considered this have said that you can consider the disability benefits as a factor in
yes.
the overall financial condition of the parties?
I do. And I've read many of those cases trying to distinguish them. They are very indistinguishable at this point.
So is it your position that we should side with the minority on this issue?
In my position, yes, I believe you should. I believe that those veterans' benefits should be left to the veteran. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.